Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme. The summer term is over for kids here in the UK, so we thought it the perfect time to take a look at how our city schools are designed and built, and how that impacts on the way that children learn and grow. We hop around the globe for some prime examples of best practice. We visit a Peruvian school that some are declaring pandemic-proof, explore a more inviting take on the usual institutions seen across China, and we take a look to the skies to assess a rising trend for schools in Australia. So take your seats, pencils at the ready, for this week's episode of The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to today's class. Quiet, please. Eyes to the front. I'm Mr. Tuck. We start today with Roseanne Bosch, the founder and creative director of Roseanne Bosch Studio in Copenhagen. This studio uses a multidisciplinary approach to design spaces that maximise learning potential and tap into the ability that design has to influence the learning process. Roseanne, thank you for joining me. Now, you've come up with a few principles for designers to think about when looking at how to make a better learning environment. Can you tell me about these principles and how you hope they'll help us reimagine school design?
Well, I think that, yes, we call them principles. That's to kind of give it a, you know, kind of a clarity, because you have to understand that when you design, because the end of what we do does result often in a physical result, meaning it's a building, it's a context, it's a place. So what we talk about, I mean, there's a difference in between, for example, saying something like creativity. I mean, what does creativity mean, and what kind of physical environment in the end enhances your creativity? So you have to go from something which is rather abstract to something which is actually very concrete, which in the end, you know, is actually built and bought, you know, and done, and is something you physically can experience. So in order to help this process, we developed what we call, you know, a set of principles or guidelines, one can say, that link the way we learn to a physical environment. But the overall world of this word, of this physical environment, is differentiation. It's basically an environment that allows for a lot of different actions, interactions, groups, small groups, big groups. Your senses are stimulated in different ways. So the six principles we use, we have them in metaphors we use to cover them. We call them cave, mountaintop, watering hole. Cave is the places where you go to focus, to concentrate. But this can also be you go for a walk, you know. So it's a learning situation where you do not communicate with your surroundings. Then we have something called campfire, which is about teamwork, about collaboration. Then we create a lot of different settings that stimulate collaboration. But again, collaboration can be many things, you know. You can stand in front of a big wall and doing a huge mind map with a group of people. You can be on a Zoom call collaborating, or you can sitting around a round table. Then we have something called watering hole, which are the places where you have a lot of informal kind of exchange of information and inspiration, where you get inspired because you maybe see something that you did not expect to see here. Then we have something we call movement, which is about actually moving your body and getting a high pulse in order to allow you to concentrate better on other moments, to become conscious about that your body needs movement. And then we have another one called hands-on education, and that's about using your hands and your body to understand something, which is different from just moving to get your pulse up. You know, for example, when you build something to understand a mathematical model, or you experiment with different textures and things like that, you know, when you actually have a much more, you know, hands-on approach to learning things. So we have these different principles, and they allow us to program a building in a different way. So instead of having, for example, dialogue with a school about, oh, we have 800 students and we need that many classrooms, we start to have a dialogue on how are your learning sequences? What do you learn? How do you learn? And what type of learning situations, different caves, different campfires, would you need, and how many of these in order to create for the best possible learning landscape. We don't call them schools, we call them learning landscape.
What's interesting then is that when someone phones you, they shouldn't just think they're going to get a building from you. It sounds that you're very involved in what the kind of curriculum is, how teaching is going to happen as well.
Yes, very much. We talk to them. I mean, the curriculum in a lot of cases is actually defined by often a government or something that you don't really always have an influence on. So what we look at is what can we change? Where can we make a difference and where can't we? So that's also part of it. And we always try to push for the max, you know, and then from there on, we start having a dialogue and designing, because what works for one doesn't work necessarily for the other. So you also have to understand we don't have one solution. What we're trying to do, for example, is to create, like I say, a learning landscape, to try to create an environment that allows for as much differentiation as possible. Because in a way, it sounds maybe obvious, but when we talk about preparing children or people for an uncertain future or an uncertainty or the ability to improvise, which we really lived very intensively under COVID now, I mean, to prepare people for this kind of creative mindset or uncertainty means that you actually have to be exposed to a lot of different situations, that you have to use your knowledge, but in many different ways. If you always learn French in a wide classroom in a certain setting, you will be very likely to only be able to speak French in this specifically same setting, but not at the moment when you're in a nightclub or on a market. So the thing is, if you want to embed knowledge, I mean, really make it yours, you don't only have to, you know, learn it, you also have to do it and practice it in many differentiated situations. And then apart from that, another element which is really important for learning and which we know from the work we do is motivation. If you are not motivated to learn what you do, you're very likely to at least learn very inefficient.
The pandemic, as you mentioned, has shaken up education, stopped many kids being able to go to school all around the world. You've now come up with this design for a school in Peru, which is pandemic proof. It would be able to remain open during any crisis. How have you done that?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, I mean, it's also that sometimes media pick up something and they think it's a great thing to say, you know, and to say pandemic proof. I wouldn't say that we'll be able to be open under any type of circumstances. That's kind of a big claim to make, you know. But I do think that it's the best possible way of preparing with the knowledge we have today. First of all, it's very flexible, fluid environment, which is in open connection with the exterior. Another part, we also only talk about a pandemic. We don't talk so much about climate change and, you know, all the sustainability. But one of the things that are for a lot of schools and for a lot of young people are very important is sustainability and maybe also the connection to nature. So what we're trying to do with that school is that it's a school where you have a natural connection with the outdoor environment. So kind of blurring the lines in between the inside and the outside. They are so lucky that they actually have this environment in Lima, which has a big open green area. We call it the green heart. So the school's kind of embracing this green heart and having a very fluid spaces that all open up to each other and into this open green space. And then in a way to connect all the spaces, we have something we call the Rio Hablador, which means the talking river, which is a concept coming from a Peruvian story. And it's about the river, which is a, you know, it's a god transformed into a river. And he tells all the small stories. So actually the connecting areas are places where you can tell stories, where you can exhibit things, where you can meet others, where you have these different learning situations. And they are very fluent going in and out. I mean, the worst what you can have in a pandemic in Corona times is putting 30 people in a small room, close the door and close the window and make them sit in there, breathe on top of each other for, you know, several hours. So what we did is that we made a very open half outdoor, half indoor space, which is very fluid, meaning that if you can't be more than five people in a group, well, you can have lots of small groups of five people. I mean, you don't have to be in one space. You can have a lot of variation and a lot of flexibility, and you can always be out and inside all the time.
And I would encourage people to look at your website and see the amazing work that you've done. It's colourful. You can see the use of tactile materials, the access to daylight, the involvement of the outdoor space, of nature coming into the build. It's all incredibly wonderful. But, you know, the Markham College in Peru, I looked at their fees this morning, it's up to $18,000 to go to the college. How can schools or places that don't have that access to a good sponsor who's able to pay all of the things that you're talking about, how can they, other smaller schools, begin to learn from your work? Do you think that they can, in a way, steal some ideas from you, that there are things that become principles that anybody could tap into?
Definitely, yes. And we also do that. We have a bit of model where we have clients that obviously can afford us to invent something new. And then we take this new knowledge and kind of spread it out on the other side to schools that maybe not be able to afford us making specially for them something entirely new, but can sort of get inspired by it and implement it themselves. I published a book called Designing for a Better World Starts at School. And there are the six principles we use explained in it, also with a spatial kind of context. I mean, in a way, it's a space algorithm, and it's about using your spaces in a different way. It's not necessarily about having spaces in a different way. It's about thinking them in a different way and using them in a different way. It's about thinking that if you put 30 kids in one room and you talk to them and you just make them sit passively receiving or just listening to you, thinking that then they will learn. This is not the best way of learning. If you want children to learn, you have to activate them. You have to make that this knowledge they receive becomes part of them, becomes relevant. And with this Designing for a Better World little book, I mean, I made it on purpose because I felt the frustration of not being able to share this. So this is what we share. It's like a small guide. Go ahead, do it. I mean, you can sit under a tree, have a fantastic campfire situation where you have a fantastic dialogue and teamwork. It doesn't require necessarily a totally new building.
Roseanne Bosch, founder and creative director of Roseanne Bosch Studio in Copenhagen there. And thank you very much for joining me. For the next lesson, we head to China. Open architecture is a Beijing-based practice with some truly innovative designs when it comes to educational facilities, especially in comparison with other Chinese schools.
If I can use two keywords that summarize the aims, I would like to use radical and poetics. Because I think for us, these are the things equally important and equally often missing these days, that the things need to be radical and powerful, but at the same time, it's poetic. You know, it touches the soul, it touches people.
That's Li Hu, along with Wen Jinghuang, founded Open Architecture. Earlier, the two joined the urbanist Carlotta Ribello to talk about their work on a new Shanghai campus dubbed School as a Village, a response to the widespread prevalence of overscaled and generic schools in China. Wen Jing began by describing the thinking behind this project.
The name we gave to the project, School as a Village, sort of summarize what we wanted to do at the time. We want to create a decentralized campus for a K-12 school. More and more we realized, you know, educating young person, what you learn in books is equally important as what you learn in nature. What you do inside classrooms and outside classrooms are equally important. So in this school, we take the natural element, the outdoor open spaces, equally important as the classrooms, the libraries, and the other educational facilities. So this, we wanted to create a village-like campus for a pretty large school in the urban setting. So in a way, when I look back at it, I think consciously and subconsciously, we were learning from the traditional Chinese scholarly gardens that you create a natural environment in limited urban land and with layers of elements you can employ, like trees, bamboo forest, trails, and pond, wetland. I guess we are trying to create an experience for students, sort of like when we were kids before, that you go through a small forest to go between your classrooms and your labs. We want to create this kind of rich, relaxed experience for kids from kindergarten to middle school on this campus.
on your website, on the description you have for the project, you mention how, you know, this is a direct response to, you know, the generic school complexes in China. I'm curious then if you could expand a bit more on that for our listeners. You know, how does this design go against the trends in China's educational facilities?
You know, the Chinese education facilities changes over time. So I would like to just talk about the majorities of the current context of what's really happening. What's happening is that with the rapid urbanization, there's a huge demand of building more schools as more people flood into the cities. So what we see in a way, the problematic aspect of that is the schools are getting larger and larger and denser as a kind of learning environment. What we're trying to break in differently is that to break down that scale, the massive scale imposed on kids, and also to encourage individuality. You know, I think that's really important. I would also say something kind of missing is the whole cultivation of individuality, finding that sense of freedom to develop oneself. So in the school village, as you can see, that you feel the sense of playfulness, the sense of openness, and the sense of hopefully inspire you to search for individuality. Against a more massive, monolithic, often in the form of megastructure, as a kind of majority representation of the schools being built these days.
Yeah, you notice there are a lot of secondary schools being built in China. In the recent years, there's this surge of demands for better education for kids. And most of the schools are done in a typical way of half of the land of the school is occupied by the sports field, the track and field sports field, and half of the land is for the teaching building. In most of the time in one connected building, large structure. So this is what Lee mentioned, the mega structure as a school typology. And this is what you read on our website, our direct response to sort of dismantling this prevailing typology, and we're trying to create something new.
Now, one of the elements when you talk about, you know, the need to break up this idea of having, you know, the monolithic one big element as this school building and create all these different elements, one of them also involves the community, and this is a bibliotheater, both for school and for the community. How important do you feel that is to have spaces like that, that open up outside, beyond the realms of the campus?
This is very important to us, and luckily important to our client as well. We all recognize, you know, school buildings has quite substantial time that's not being used during the summer and winter breaks, during weekends. And so if we can share these facilities like the library, the theater, the gym, the swimming pool with the community, and the resources we devote in building them will be more effectively used. So luckily the client has an agreement on that. We placed these buildings that could be shared with the community on the periphery of the site, and they can be accessed easily without making the management of the school too much complicated. And as probably true in a lot of places in urban schools, you know, the school, especially in China, school can be a center attracting many families around in the community. And by using these facilities at different times, the school can function as a social energizer, making the community much more vibrant and connected.
And I guess just finally, the name, School as a Village, and the saying that, you know, it does take a village to raise someone. I quite like the similarities between the two of them. So I am curious, just finally, to get your sense of how do you see schools evolving in the future? You know, the requirements or the needs from the students and staff for what makes the ideal school? How do you see in the future the ideal school, how it would look like?
I think the design of the school, the physical environment, really reflects the philosophy of education. And I think globally, in fact, the huge anxiety comes from the concerns about education in every country, right? as the society is changing, technology is changing, and the job and the career, everything's changing, evolving, education must evolve. I think it's not just only in China, but China especially. Education is a huge social debate and agenda. But from our point of view, we as the architect, as observers, as parents, I think there's a lot to be replaced on the education of the individual, you know, the understanding of the world, the understanding of society, the understanding of nature, and also the importance of the cultural dimensions in a very early education, art, you know, reading, sports, you know, building a full personality instead of you just a testing machine, you know, just scoring for your next school. In the end, what's the meaning of that? So I think the facility of the education to really keep up with that and probably even get ahead of that inspires how to bring nature and building better facility for the engagement of art and the library facilities and better and different kind of outdoor environment that encourage the students to get in the exercise, you know, the physical exercise. I think that can all be facilitated with a better design of the campus environment through innovation. That I'm quite hopeful, and we are definitely doing more of that. I think School Village and our earlier scheme at the Garden School, which was also quite important campus case, I think for many, many school as a model, all different kind of effort and attempts to make a different kind of school that for future education.
Li Hu and Wenjing Huang there, the two founding partners of Open Architecture, and they were speaking with Monocle's Carlotta Ribello. Now, before I let you go for lunch, we're going to take a quick trip to Australia. In the ever-densifying world, schools have had to battle for real estate, and the result is often that urban schools lack the wealth of facilities that their suburban counterparts are awarded. But clever design and a more vertical perspective is bringing city kids some much-needed school pride. Elaine Roff is an urban planner and a director at Urbis, a creative community of practice experts working collaboratively to deliver fresh thinking and independent advice across Australia. Elaine is based in Sydney, where she was involved in the government approval for the vertical campus of Inner Sydney High School, as well as working with the architects on its built form. Monocle's Nick Manise caught up with Elaine earlier to talk about how to plan city schools, and he began by asking about vertical campuses and what challenges they present to an urban planner.
We're definitely shifting away from the traditional education model of a campus. So, you know, typically it's low scale, they're on larger sites, they're, you know, maybe one or two stories, maybe up to four stories. They've got plenty of open space and fields. But we're seeing a lot of regeneration of inner urban areas, and educational establishments are a bit of an anchor for centres in those regenerated areas. So we're definitely seeing a move towards that location. And in those locations, you know, sites are smaller, they're more constrained and denser. So that's where we're seeing the rise of the vertical campus. And in the work that we do, we're typically dealing with vertical campuses that are around 6 to 14 stories for schools and around that 19, 20 stories for universities. I know that the New South Wales State Education Department doesn't really want to do vertical campuses of more than 12 stories. It just kind of gets a bit, well, costly for one, but also just a bit hard to manage with students moving around.
What are the compromises, if there are any, that you have to make when working, planning, designing on a vertical campus? How do you make up for perhaps the shortfall in space for sports fields? What's the relationship there?
Well, I think it's an attitude shift as well. I mean, we have that view, that traditional view of what a school looks like. You've got to have ground floor access. You've got to have fields to run around in. But that's not necessarily the way kids interact. We know that they don't really have a lot of time to eat and play during their breaks. They've got to eat, they've got to chat with their friends, they've got to play on their phones. So they're not really running around a field the way people think they do. The field is usually for training and after hours or school afternoon sports, and they often get shipped out to other facilities. I've worked on a town centre school where we were constrained. We didn't have fields, but we had to get the planning authorities to wrap their head around the fact that the kids play quite differently. It's more passive play. And we had shared use arrangements with council where council and the community could access the school facilities and the school could use the council's fields. So first of all, there's an attitude shift that needs to happen. I know that some designers have said that kids really need to connect to the ground, but again, that's a really traditional way of looking at it. Kids live in apartment buildings. They don't have direct access to ground level, so they're not expecting to be educated in that same way. And I think one of the biggest issues is obviously circulation and movement. You've got to be able to move kids around quite easily. They've got to be able to get to their classes. You're moving hundreds of kids at any one time. So when you are designing and planning for schools, for example, you know, lifts are really, really important. I've worked on a school where the lift situation was that each year group had a destination and the lift took them to that destination. And so they weren't able to access every single floor by lift. If they wanted to move around per level, they had to use the stairs. So the lift took them to their year group and then they moved around the rest of the campus via stairs. So that's one way of dealing with it. Staggered start times is another way. So maybe the junior kids start a bit earlier. The senior kids start a bit later, so there's less demand on the lifts. And, you know, there's obviously costs involved in lots of lift cores, so that's a real consideration. And I think, you know, one of the sacrifices, well, it shouldn't be a sacrifice, it should be an opportunity, and that's adaptability. It's making sure that the building is fit for purpose now, but can be adapted as the needs of students and users change over time. So we're seeing more flexible spaces, more flexible learning spaces, and opportunities to kind of grow into buildings. So you might not necessarily need the full school on day one, term one. So looking at opportunities to use some of those underutilized spaces for other purposes. Some of those things, even though they're sacrifices, they're really opportunities and designers are taking that on board.
I guess just finally, I want to talk about one specific project. You worked on the Inner Sydney High School in Surry Hills. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and I guess why it was significant for the city?
Yeah, it was a fantastic project. I loved being involved in it. It's a government school and a high school, so year 7 to 12. It's the second recent high-rise school for the state education department. So they had a lot of lessons learned from the first one. And I think because of the lessons learned, it was a smoother process. And they really, you know, they had the challenges of the vertical circulation, which they were able to probably deal with in a slightly better way. It's a really small site on the corner of two major roads. It also adjoins a large park, public park. So they were constrained in the sense that, you know, we've got to have safety. Safety is the first and foremost issue. There's no parking because it's too dangerous for cars to be coming in and out of the site. And you're not allowed to overshadow the park at all during certain hours. So you had to design the tower. The architects were FGMT, amazing architects. So you had to really carefully design the tower so not to overshadow that park during those times. The site also contains some older school buildings which are heritage listed. So the site originally had a 1960s building at the back of those heritage school buildings that was demolished as part of the project, and the new tower was placed behind the current heritage buildings. So that was a constraint, and the tower really had to sort of respect that curtilage and manage that sort of visual and significant relationship, which I think they did a really good job of. So the tower form was split into three parts, and each part sort of represented its context. So the podium level really respected the heritage items, the middle level sort of respected the park setting, and then the top element respected the more high-rise elements of the CBD, which is not too far away, and the surrounding residential development. So, yeah, it was a really great project. Certainly not without its challenges, but the result is, you know, just a fantastic architectural building. It's got 360 views of Sydney, and year 7 and 8 students are in there already as of day one, term one this year.
Elaine Roth, Director Urbis there, in conversation with Monocle's Nick Manise. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Top marks go to our producers, the straight A student, Carlos Rebello, and head boy, David Stevens. David also edited the show. Don't let that get in the way of your studies, though, Stevens. To play you out of this week's episode, here's Louis Armstrong with You Don't Learn That in School. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
King Arthur was a hero who was famous everywhere. He had a big round table because he couldn't stand a square. You don't learn that in school. I said you don't learn that in school. Oh, there ain't no doubt about it. Learn that in school.